third case, Schott versus Rush Presbyterian.
Good morning. My name is Michael Cleveland, and I represent the defendant appellant, Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center. The first of the three attorney's fees issues presented in this case relates to whether or not Judge Gottschall abused her discretion by awarding two plaintiffs attorney's fees incurred for the first trial that was had in this case. Like other employment discrimination statutes and other fee-shifting statutes, the Americans with Disabilities Act provides for an award of reasonable attorney's fees. This court's decision in Jaffe versus Redmond expressly holds that where a second trial is necessitated by a plaintiff's unreasonable strategy at the first trial, no fee should be awarded for that first trial. Plaintiff on this appeal does not challenge that as the governing principle. In this case, Judge Gottschall granted Rush a second trial on its new trial motion, expressly finding plaintiff's strategy at the first trial to have been unreasonable.
Were the attorney's fees broken down as to claim related?
The attorney's fees were not broken down as to claim related. What Judge Gottschall did was reduce the attorney's fees awarded by one-third to reflect that plaintiff had not prevailed on all the claims that were presented at the first trial.
But when they were, my question is, and you've answered it, when they were filed, they weren't related to claim, just...
It's simply one bill, if you will, submitted to the court.
Do we know what her contract with her lawyers says?
We do not know what the contract with her lawyer says. It was never filed with the court. We do know that there's no evidence that particularly with regards to the third issue in this case, the prejudgment interest, that it calls for any such interest that was ever billed or collected. We do know that plaintiff is obligated to pay the attorney's fees charged by her attorneys. In other words, she's not a contingent fee plaintiff.
But we don't know what they are.
We do know what the representation made.
What she owes the lawyers.
The representation made was that she owes the lawyers what they presented in their initial fee petition. Now, beyond that,
$400,000 or something.
Well, the original claim was for some, I believe it was well in excess of $400,000. I think it was like $550,000.
Oh, wow.
The reduction takes it down effectively to $412,000.
Well, does she owe them the $550 or the $412?
Your Honor, I do not know.
Yeah. But you're saying she owes them at least $412, or that's the
assumption. Based on plaintiff's representations in the district court, Dr. Schott owes her lawyers that.
Am I correct? You argue that by virtue of the alternative minimum income tax, which I fortunately have never had to pay, she's actually going to be worse off if she gets the attorney's fees?
She certainly is. She recovered a judgment of $60,000 in this case. She owes the Internal Revenue Service at least $125,000 in taxes. So clearly she's twice as worse off, if you want to look at it that way, by virtue of the fact that she owes them twice what her recovery was. And I point out, by the way, that does not...
We actually know that she owes the IRS... Is this your calculation?
This is our calculation.
That's your... Is there other evidence in the record about what she owes or doesn't? I did the
only evidence in the record is our calculation. Dr. Schott has never disputed that calculation.
Oh, I see. She didn't present her own,
No, and on appeal, there's been no assertion made that that's necessarily wrong. Now, interestingly enough, the suggestion is made that perhaps some of those fees might be rebated to Dr. Schott by her counsel. And, of course, if that's the case, that might or might not affect her tax liability. But if that happens, then they're not attorney's fees in the first place. What they are is hidden damages awarded not by the jury and not by the court, but by plaintiff's counsel. So either way, that question might be answered. Are they going to be rebated or not? Clearly, that impacts the recoverability of, in our view, the fees from Rush in this case. With respect to returning to the new trial issue, it's important to note that in the district court, plaintiffs did not challenge the ruling that the trial strategy had been unreasonable and did not try to, by means of a reconsideration motion, for example, and did not appeal that decision. So therefore, that decision stands for purposes of this court's considerations of the issues now presented.
But that's not the trial judge's characterization, is it?
Well, I think it is the trial judge's characterization. Judge Gottschall expressly said in granting Rush a new trial that in certain circumstances, the trial strategy pursued might have been reasonable, but not in this case. So Judge Gottschall clearly in granting a new trial found the strategy to be unreasonable.
Well, didn't the trial judge reference her own issue with the instructions as contributing to
She did, but that in a way is all of a piece, because it was Rush's proffered and urged instruction which Judge Gottschall said might have alleviated the confusion. However, that instruction was not given because it was opposed by plaintiff during the instruction conference. Of course, this is all part of the record.
So you're suggesting the strategy to oppose instruction that you feel would have been critical is to be charged as strategy?
There's a line here, of course, between trial strategy and aggressive representation of a party on the one hand and pursuit of an unreasonable trial strategy on the other. And what we have here is overall, as the judge determined, an unreasonable trial strategy. To allow counsel unbridled discretion to take positions in the district court without the potential, if those positions result in the necessity of a second trial because the first trial has been unfair and prejudicial to the defendant, gives trial counsel absolute discretion as to what positions to argue and imposes no restraint. It shifts, as happened here, all of the evidence and all of the burden to the defendant. Now, one of the plaintiff in this court argues that the decision to grant Rush a new trial was solely a matter of determination that the verdict was against the manifest weight of the evidence. That, of course, is incorrect. First of all, if that were true, there was no necessity for Judge Gottschall to go through the trial strategy analysis to consider the decision or not to give that instruction. And furthermore, of course, it was necessary, as cases from this court illustrate, for her to consider whether or not the decision was against the manifest weight of the evidence, because it is theoretically possible that there might have been enough evidence in the record to sustain the ADA verdict of the first trial. But of course, Judge Gottschall found that there was not. And indeed, she found that there was ample evidence that had come in at the first trial that didn't belong there in the first place. All, again, of
did she make any, did she offer any, I've forgotten that, did she offer any views on the merit of the plaintiff's religious discrimination claim?
Not in her new trial ruling. She did not offer any decisions on that at all, any indication on her views of that at all, as I recall.
But the jury rejected it.
The jury returned a verdict for Rush on that claim. That's correct.
In the second trial?
At the first trial.
In the first trial?
At the first trial. There were certain ADA claims and the Title VII religion claim and retaliation claims tried at the first trial. The verdict returned was, at the first trial, solely an ADA claim.
And that's the only thing you went forward in the second trial?
That's right. That's the only issue that went forward at the second trial was the ADA claim. I think in these circumstances, it was clearly an
abuse. Were there any settlement negotiations between the first and second trial?
I do not believe that there were such negotiations, but I was not representing Rush at that time, so I cannot definitively answer that question. I do know that at various times after the settlement negotiations before Judge Williams that, and I think we've said this in our briefs, that Rush indicated an interest in perhaps settling this matter, and those efforts were rebuffed. I can't tell you exactly when those discussions took place. In sum, I think with regard to this first issue, the awarded fees for the first trial, given Judge Gottschall's findings, given the Jaffe decision, and given the sound reasons as a matter of policy that underlie Jaffe, it was an abuse of discretion for Judge Gottschall to have awarded plaintiff Dr. Schott fees for those for the
in
first
those,
trial.
In those cases like Jaffe, were there multiple claims in which some or one prevailed and the rest didn't?
In Jaffe, there was only one claim, and I believe that in all the other cases, although I'm not certain of this, it was still only one claim. But the issue in Jaffe was actually kind of an evidentiary, a privilege.
Do you see any distinction in those circumstances where you have, in, as we have here, two or three claims that failed and one successful?
None whatsoever, because it's all one trial, firstly, and secondly, the ADA evidence that was admitted and that was thrown at the jury to let the jury sort it out included evidence on the ADA claim that Judge Gottschall ruled shouldn't have been admitted in the first place anyway. So that there, I don't think it's appropriate to analyze this as being simply a dependent upon the fact there are multiple claims. It makes it doesn't change that from Jaffe.
Well, that
at
goes
all.
Back to my initial question, which you answered, and that is the as far as you're aware, the attorney fees were not broken down into claim specific.
That's correct. And indeed, the argument was, which Judge Gottschall accepted, was that some of the attorney fees on the claims that were lost were relevant, if you will, to the overall trial of the case on the claims that were won. Turning to the second issue in this case, and that regards the settlement offer. In Moriarty versus Speck, this court recognized that a district court may take a substantial settlement offer into account in deciding fees. Defined substantial as an amount equal to or more than the total damages recovered. Again, plaintiff does not dispute this principle of law, and obviously there are plenty of sound reasons for it. It certainly would be inappropriate to reward a party or their attorney with attorney fees when the party has turned down an offer that would have put her in the same place or even better off than the judgment obtained. Any other rule provides no incentive for counsel to fairly evaluate their case and adds to the burdens already imposed on the court system. In this case, though we have shown, and as I've already mentioned, plaintiff is clearly worse off, plaintiff nonetheless maintains that she's better off, which is inexplicable since she owes the IRS $125,000 and received a judgment of $60,000. And also, I indicated that regardless of whatever the answer may be to whether or not plaintiff will be rebating a portion of the fees to Dr. Schott, the fact of the matter is that the it nonetheless makes either an award of those rebated amounts inappropriate because they're not attorney's fees or simply leaves Dr. Schott in the position that she's in. Plaintiff contends that non-monetary items should be taken into account under Moriarty. Moriarty doesn't do that. Plaintiff also contends that this retraction statement that was drafted by Judge Williams and urged by Judge Williams at the settlement conference somehow takes this out of Moriarty. It does not. The retraction statement is innocuous. And certainly, plaintiff's claims in this case would have stood on the public record regardless of the execution of that retraction statement. The end result of the rejection of the settlement offer that Rush made is that plaintiff does face an enormous tax liability of more than twice the amount of judgment, so her attorneys may recover $412,000 in attorney's fees. There's something fundamentally wrong with that, and it was an abuse of discretion not to take those considerations into account. Lastly, with regard to prejudgment interest, Dr. Schott was a paying client. She has presented no evidence that she has any obligation to pay her attorneys prejudgment interest or that she has paid prejudgment interest. Nonetheless, the district court awarded prejudgment interest.
Well, are the attorney's fees here being computed on the basis of these lawyers' current rates or some historical rate?
The attorney's fees are computed on the basis of historic rates. And in this court's decision in People Who Care, first of all, it's a contingent fee case, but even if that analysis applies, the People Who Care case says it's incumbent upon the person seeking fees to present evidence of the that the market awards interest in these circumstances. There's no such interest here. And Judge Gottschall's decision that plaintiffs should recover prejudgment.
Well, what is your, I mean, this is a little unfair question, but what's your law firm's practice? I mean, suppose I don't know if you ever do this, but suppose you agree to handle some case at an hourly fee that's going to be paid at the end of the case. Maybe it's a minimum against the contingent fee or something. Would there be an adjustment for inflation, or does that ever arise, or do you just bill currently? So,
well, first of all, our ordinary practice is to bill currently.
And do you have a little note which says no interest is paid within 30 days?
Indeed we do.
Indeed
we do. Right. And there's no evidence here that was in any way, shape, or form the agreement between Dr. Schott and her attorneys. Just to close on this issue, Judge Gottschall ruled as a matter of law that Dr. Schott was entitled to prejudgment interest. That is wrong. This court's decision says that Dr. Schott had to present some evidence she didn't. So that decision should be reversed as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Quinn. Ms. Inman?
May it please the court, my name is Cynthia Heinemann, and I represent Dr. Susan Schott. I'd like to go first to the issue of the prejudgment interest that you were just talking about with Mr. Cleveland. It is law settled under Missouri versus Jenkins since 1989 that in a final fee award, a plaintiff is entitled to be compensated for delay. And in fact, the fees here were charged at a historical rate. And under this court's cases, Smith versus Maywood and In Re Continental Securities, it is proper and was proper for Judge Gottschall to calculate interest on those historical rates in order to compensate for the delay. And Rush is not addressed.
Who's being compensated?
Who's being compensated? The attorneys are being compensated here, Your Honor. The record is that Dr. Schott has paid some of the fees, but she's not paid all the fees. And the attorneys here have been waiting some 8 or 9 years to be paid in these circumstances. And under the case law, in order to fully compensate and to compensate for the loss of the time value of that money, some sort of calculation needs to be made. And the court allows either current rates to be charged or for historical rates plus interest. Judge Gottschall awarded the historical rates plus interest, and that was a proper calculation for her to make. In fact, Rush did not challenge the calculation below. They challenged the fact that they said, as a matter of law, we were not entitled to be paid prejudgment interest on the fees. And that simply isn't true under Missouri versus Jenkins, Smith versus Maywood, and In Re Continental Securities.
But how come the contract with the lawyers is not part of the record?
Rush never asked for the contract between the lawyers.
You're asking for fees. I would think that the contract would be illuminating as to what the expectations of the lawyers were.
Well, it could be illuminating as to what the expectations of the lawyers were. In fact, it's not relevant to a calculation of fees, as the Supreme Court found in Blanchard versus Bergeron. What the actual arrangement is between the lawyer and the plaintiff is irrelevant. What the court is
able to... It's not irrelevant, because suppose the contract contains some kind of interest rate, delay compensation. That would be very illuminating for a court deciding what interest rate would be appropriate to compensate the lawyers for delay, wouldn't it?
It could be, yes. I don't mean to say that it's totally irrelevant, Your Honor. What I mean to say is that it shouldn't preclude the award of interest in this case.
It's not controlling.
That's right, Your Honor. It's not controlling in this case. And I'd like to turn now to the issue of the first trial. The trial judge here addressed the issue that Rush has raised and their argument that that she granted a new trial because of jury confusion and an unreasonable trial strategy on the part of the plaintiff. And all really Rush is doing is quibbling with the district court here. The district court, in her decision granting the attorney's fee petition, said she rejected the defendant's claim that the second trial was necessitated by errors induced by the plaintiff. The defendant's motion for a new trial was granted because the court concluded that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. And now Rush comes in and says she's wrong. They have to show that she was fundamentally wrong. And this court has said...
But there's something goofy, it seems to me, about this case, because why should Rush be... I mean, it sounds as if Rush is being asked to pay the Internal Revenue Service because of this sort of botched litigation, which involves, you know, over-aggressive activity by the lawyers in the first trial and a refusal of the settlement. They end up with a pathetically small judgment and a huge bill from the IRS if you get attorney's fees. I don't get it.
Well, Your Honor, first of all...
It doesn't make any sense.
First of all, the huge bill from the IRS is not in the record.
Maybe he's wrong, but what your opponent said was that, you know, he presented his estimate of what the alternative minimum income tax would do to your client, and that you didn't counter that.
He is wrong because he didn't present it to the trial court. That is a newly minted argument that was created when this case got appealed. There was no mention of tax liability below, and Judge Gottschall was never given the opportunity to address it, and neither were we. There is no evidence in the record to support the calculation that Rush has made of Dr. Schott's tax liability. We simply don't know what it is. It's pure conjecture on their part, pure speculation, and a new argument they've made here because they realized the argument they made below was factually incorrect on the record in the case.
On what basis was your fee award in the first case reduced by 33%?
The fee award was reduced across the board by 33%, Your Honor, and it was based on the trial judge's determination that Dr. Schott had limited success. Because she
I understand bring it was limited success, but there was, and I explored this with your opposing counsel, there was no allocation of your costs based on claims.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the trial judge did find that the claims were related, as she was obligated to do in order to first determine the lodestar fee. And then she is allowed to reduce them for the degree of success, and she did that based on a third. I don't recall that she had a particular calculation in mind. It was not a number that had been presented by Rush.
How many verdicts? There was one with the ADA claim, one on retaliation.
That's correct. There were three claims at the first trial and one on religious discrimination.
Now, maybe I was mistaken. Because about alternative minimum income tax, because you said on page 18 of your brief, Dr. Schott's attorneys might agree to take a haircut on their fees to accommodate her tax liability.
That was posed, Your Honor, only to address the situation that, to address the argument that it's not in the record, and so it is impossible for Rush to come into this court and say Dr. Schott is going to have to pay the IRS $125,000 and she's going to be worse off as a result of that. She is going to get the total fee award in this case. It is awarded to the plaintiff under the law, and she will have, if this court affirms the district court's judgment.
You said the alternative minimum tax likely does have this effect.
It could.
In fee-shifting cases. So apparently there's some... Actually, I wrote an opinion about this. There is a problem here, isn't
there? There is a problem with alternative minimum tax, Your Honor. I agree. But it's not before this court. The argument has been waived. It was just created here by Rush in an attempt to show that the settlement offer that was made in March of 1995 of $0 was a better offer than Dr. Schott got. Would have put Dr. Schott in a better position than she ultimately ended up in. And the other problem with the arguments there that Rush presents with respect to the settlement and the tax liability is that they assume the tax liability to, in order to argue, they assume the tax liability on the fees that the trial judge has awarded in order to claim that we're not entitled to those fees. It's a circular argument, and it would be no more fair for us to come into the court and say, well, we're better off because we now have a judgment of $60,000 and over $500,000 in attorney's fees. And so clearly we're better off. What you need to compare, and what Moriarty says you should compare, is the $60,000 damage
actually
award.
Might be, your client might be better off with a smaller attorney's fee award, one that didn't trigger alternative minimum income tax liability.
She might be, but we don't know, Your Honor.
Well, you'd think it would be the most important thing to your client.
It may be the most important thing to your client.
Odd that you don't know whether you're defending an appeal which will actually, if you win, make your client worse off.
I haven't delved into the income status of my client, and she hasn't asked me to.
You can't, after you get the bill from the IRS, you can't come back to us and say, well, actually, I shouldn't have defended that appeal.
No, Your Honor, I agree that we can't.
You haven't discussed this, apparently, with your client.
We have not discussed it with my client.
Because this is a grudge case, isn't it?
This is not... I don't think it's a grudge case.
I think it's a grudge case.
Certainly, it's not on for a long time.
I'm willing to incur substantial fees to whack Rush.
I think
that's why she wouldn't make the settlement and make the apology.
Now, Your Honor, I don't think that's the case, and I don't know that there's anything in the record to assume that. Dr. Schott has now had two juries determine that Rush violated her rights, her civil rights. As a disabled person, and I don't think that you can characterize anything as a grudge match when you have two separate juries in two separate incidences find that there's been a violation of the law. Perhaps it's a grudge match at this point where Rush is fighting the attorney's fees that were awarded by Judge Gottschall.
Yes, but it would be odd if both sides had would gain financially from a reversal. The unique.
Going to the situation with respect to the tax liability, there simply is not any evidence in the record to support Rush's position here, and without that, they have not met the burden of showing that Dr. Schott would be worse off. But more importantly, Judge Gottschall, the trial judge, did exactly what Moriarty asked her to do, which is to consider the settlement and factor it into her calculation on the fees. And she did precisely that. She looked at the settlement, and she determined, as she was allowed to do under Moriarty, under the circumstances of this case, it was not reasonable for her to reduce the fee any further. And Rush has not challenged that that determination of hers. They say merely that she couldn't look at anything beyond the monetary value, but that's not what Moriarty says.
Can we return to the one-third reduction for a moment?
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understand it, the trial judge, in explaining her action, acknowledged that the doctor's presentation of evidence likely contributed to jury confusion, but then said under some circumstances this would have been a reasonable strategy. I have a little bit of a problem putting an equal sign in those comments for the purposes of going through her reasoning. I appreciate we have an abuse of discretion standard here, but I just thought maybe you could...
I think there is some confusion in the order granting the new trial, and I would agree with that. Rush has obviously interpreted it the way that they would like to, but the trial court has a subjectively superior understanding of the litigation in this case, and this court has found on a number of occasions that you will defer to that. And I don't know what more subjective opinion that could be than...
That's not responsive to Chief Judge Flom's question. The question is this: should lawyers be rewarded when they deliberately adopt a strategy of confusing the jury or other trier of fact? Suppose a lawyer goes up before a judge and he thinks, this judge, you know, doesn't really police the admission of evidence, doesn't really enforce Rule 403 of the Rules of Evidence properly, and therefore I think I can get a lot of junk in here and bamboozle the jury. And suppose indeed that strategy works to the extent of getting a swollen jury verdict, but then the judge grants a new trial. Should lawyers be rewarded for that strategy?
I don't believe that lawyers should be rewarded for that strategy, but I don't think that it's clear from this record that that's what happened.
Well, I was parroting, just listening to what the Chief Judge quoted from Judge Gottschall, it sounded as if that was her characterization of the plaintiff's trial strategy.
That was at the time that that's what the order said, and I won't dispute that. But later, when Rush said to her, you've got to not award any fees for the first trial because you found that they engaged in an unreasonable trial strategy, she said, no, I didn't. What I did was find that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence, and I didn't give an instruction that I should have given to make it clearer. And it wasn't plaintiff's fault. And in fact, if you look at the instruction conference, Your Honor, it's clear that it was the trial judge who rejected the instruction. And certainly plaintiff's objected, and I wouldn't represent otherwise.
The instruction wouldn't have done anything.
The instruction was a major part of Rush's argument.
And no one takes that seriously.
That was
if you throw a lot of junk at a jury and get them all, you know, inflamed about the plaintiff's health condition, and then give them an instruction, say, oh, by the way, you know, you heard all this stuff, but you shouldn't. That's not a realistic approach to jury psychology.
Yeah, I see my time's up. If you would like me to respond.
You certainly may respond.
It was Rush who pointed out that the instruction was a problem, and it was a large part of their argument to the trial court in their motion for a new trial.
Of course, in a motion for a new trial or an appeal, you always challenge the instructions. That's very different from the judge actually believing that an instruction would have made a difference.
Well, whether she believed it or not, she in fact wrote that in her opinion.
She obviously changed her mind a number of times in the course of this litigation.
I don't know that she changed her mind. I don't think the record is clear on that. I think that there was granted a confusing opinion granting the new trial, and she helped to clear it up by making it clearer in her order for the petition for the attorney's fees as to what really what she really meant in that order.
Could you just give me a sequence on the instruction? Did both sides present, I'm sure the record will tell us, but maybe you can short circuit it for me. Both sides present competing instructions, and they both sides opposed.
There were competing instructions on this particular situation, Your Honor. There was an instruction presented by Rush asking the jury to focus on events after May 27, 1994, which was the point at which Dr. Schott admittedly asked for a reasonable accommodation. We opposed, the plaintiffs opposed that instruction on the grounds that there was evidence prior to that date that we thought was relevant to the claim, and so we didn't like the focus language. We agreed that there could be an instruction that said she didn't ask for an accommodation until May 27, 1994, and so Rush had no obligation until that point to accommodate her. Judge Gottschall listened to both sides. We presented that as an alternative. She did determine that we didn't need the focus on the events instruction, and she rejected it.
So the court didn't come up with another.
There was no alternative. And then in the second trial, Rush presented the same instruction. We made the same argument. And in fact, what ultimately was given to the jury was an instruction that said she asked for an accommodation on May 27th, and that's when their obligation began.
In a case where there's vigorous representation on both sides, as in this case, and perhaps the error is caused by the judge not policing the admission of evidence as closely as she might, who should the burden fall on with regard to attorney's fees?
That's a difficult question. I think that it would certainly depend on the circumstances. In this circumstance, one thing that's interesting is that Judge Gottschall did not grant a new trial based on all this new evidence coming in. So, and that was something that Rush presented. So I don't think, and there were also, there was nothing during the course of the trial, there were no objections by Rush that anything was confusing. And, you know, they had made motions in limine that had been denied, and evidence came in, and there was no argument along the way that the plaintiff's attorney was acting inappropriately or trying deliberately to confuse the jury.
Well, that wasn't the thrust of my question, but I won't I
think it's difficult in a situation, Judge, to say who should bear the attorney's fees at that point.
All right, thank you, Ms. Simon.
Thank you.
Ms. Cleveland, your time expired, but you may have a minute.
Firstly, it's been asserted that the arrangements between Dr. Schott and her attorney is irrelevant on the matter of interest. The case is established that even in a contingent fee situation, the contingent fee agreement is relevant, and certainly here in the case of a paying client. Secondly, it's asserted that Rush is quibbling with Judge Gottschall's decision. Judge Gottschall's decision is extraordinarily clear as to why she granted a new trial. Insofar as you might find an inconsistency, and I don't think there is, in the second decision, that itself is an indication of an abuse of discretion because of her clear ruling on the reason for granting a new trial. Thirdly, with respect to the settlement and the matter of attorney's fees, Moriarty does not ask who caused settlement negotiations to break down, and that's the question that Judge Gottschall asked. The question asked in Moriarty is whether or not the party is better off or not, and clearly here Dr. Schott is not. With regard to the claim that this argument was not presented in the district court, of course, until there's a determination on the award of fees, it's impossible for Rush to have presented to the district court what the tax impact was. Rush's position in the district court was that plaintiff should be awarded $131,000, which is far below the threshold at which the alternative minimum tax kicks in. Thank you very much.
All right. I'm sorry, what was the last thing you said? I just, my mind was...
Rush's position in the district court was that plaintiff should be argued plaintiff should be awarded $131,000 in fees, which is far below the point at which the AMT kicks in. That's $205,000.
$205,000?
Yes, and that's set out in the footnote in our brief.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the fourth case of the day, the United States versus